This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have in the studio with me William Greider, the National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation magazine, author of six big books, at least, including Secrets of the Temple on the Federal Reserve Board, and Who Will Tell the People, and most recently, Come Home America, The Rise and Fall and Redeeming Promise of Our Country. William Greider, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
Well, it's great to be able to sit down with you. Let me start with a personal question. You were in the mainstream media. You had a great job with the Washington Post. You were very influential in the elite circles. Then you went to work for Rolling Stone and The Nation. And you write in Come Home America that you decided to start writing for the vast, undefined audience of people instead of the movers and shakers. Why'd you do that?
I seem to be drifting further and further from the influential circles in my life. A bunch of reasons. The concrete, practical one was I had been a newspaper reporter for a lot of years, an editor, and I kind of exhausted the art form, if you know what I mean, and wanted to write books and wanted to get beyond the limits of newspapers. So that was a primary motive. But the other was really I'd like to get out of that charm circle of Washington because I knew it well, and I got invited to all the right parties and that stuff. And I'm a Midwesterner. I'm still on the other side of the mountain, and culturally and every other way. And I wanted to get back closer to normal people. And Rolling Stone, I had this in my guts, but it turned out to be a brilliant move, I say for myself, because that's exactly what it did for me. Got me back in touch with real people responding to what I write.
That charm circle, though, must be seductive. But it's a phony circle, isn't it?
Well, everybody's on the make. Not everybody, but most people. I mean, all the cliches about it turn out to be true. You go to these dinner parties. I didn't do it every night or every week, but, you know, we'd go to the right dinner parties if we were invited. Catherine Graham's house or something, and you wind up at a table with every table gets a U.S. senator, and you spend dinner listening to the U.S. senator bemoan the fact that his children don't understand him. I mean, I'm not making this up. It's literally a kind of inside, and everybody nods sympathetically and says,
that's brutal, terrible,
you know. And you maybe pick up a few wobbly tidbits of political gossip, but believe me, this is about mutual sucking up both ways, politicians of media of politicians. It's not about reporting. And so I had a general kind of aversion to that. And I think I was lucky. I was at the Washington Post in probably the best years ever for reporters when Ben Bradley was editor. And he was aggressive in a kind of non-political, non-ideological way. He loved it if you stuck it in the ear of one of his pals or one of the publisher's pals. I mean, he didn't ask you to do that, but if you came up with that kind of story, he said, yeah, okay, we'll grit our teeth and run it. You know, that was the kind of editor he was. And it doesn't, you know, just didn't get better than that. Mm-hmm. So I left on a high curve.
And you haven't looked back?
No, and I did write books afterwards. I wrote a long book about the Federal Reserve. I will say immodestly in my own behalf that a Chinese publishing house just this past summer bid for the rights to publish that book, and they gave me a nice chunk of money for that right, and they're going to publish Secrets of the Temple in Chinese, which I interpret as the Chinese are going to get grown up here, and they figured my book would tell the truth about the Fed. And so, you know, it still lives. Anyway, the rest of them,
Let's talk about that book a bit, because it was a hugely influential book. I think it's an incredible book. Anyone who wants to understand how the Federal Reserve Board was created and how it works today should pick up this book, Secrets of the Temple, by my guest today, William Greider. I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. Now, the Fed is under attack by people like Ron Paul on one side and Rick Perry, who doesn't want the Federal Reserve Board to do anything that's going to help the economy between now and election time. And then Libertarian Ron Paul wants it to disappear. On the other hand, you have a different kind of critique of the Federal Reserve Board.
Yeah, and it's not just me. There is actually a very strong and coherent and I think exciting critique of the Fed, which I'm part of, but from economists with real credentials, not just reporters. And that's about reforming the Fed. My own view is it, because of its behavior in the last 20 years and particularly since the crash, we have the basis for ending the mythology of this secretive pseudo-technocratic club, or not club, but mystical temple, which makes wise decisions for the rest of us and is not accountable to anybody, especially the voters. That we got to end that and change it to a normal government agency. That's an uphill fight for sure, but the material is there to make the case. And Ron Paul and the libertarians are basically just loopy. It's just junk. His understanding of monetary policy is crackpot, to be blunt about it. Anyway, just this week, I shouldn't be talking about this because I don't know that it's public yet, but I will. I and a bunch of others were invited by Bernie Sanders to serve him on a advisory committee on reforming the Fed. And I get these emails from them pretty regularly, and they kept sending another email. Joseph Stiglitz just accepted. You know, Jamie Galbraith just accepted. I mean, it's really striking to me, and I think it's a sort of fever reading of the politics. These are people who are they're not establishment. They're on our side in terms of politics, but they have real standing. You know, Stiglitz is a Nobel Prize winner, and them signing up with Bernie Sanders tells me that they realize. This is no more important subject than changing this system, and they're willing to participate with the so-called socialist senator from Vermont.
Dennis Kucinich, I know, has a proposal to make it part of the Treasury and just situate it there and have the president make monetary policy and have it democratized that way. And there are other ways to democratize it, too.
Well, I'm a little more fundamental than Kucinich. I know his proposal. The Constitution says Congress shall regulate the money and determine its value. And it consigned that role to the Fed 100 years ago. And that was a horrendous anti-democratic decision, which we have paid for dearly ever since. So I would say Congress has to supervise and manage Federal Reserve. Now, that drives people up the wall for obvious reasons. That you're going to give the Congress the power to do all this stuff? And I have a deep faith in that institution, that it can recover its sensibilities and common sense. It has to do that gradually, but it can bring along a public that it gradually educates as it educates itself. And we really will get back to a balanced government. Not just on monetary policy, but a lot of other things. Any case, this is a good argument to have. And I feel buoyant about the possibilities that we will have that argument.
Speaking of William Grider, you had said the Federal Reserve Board performed terribly the last couple of decades, and especially during and after the crash. What did it do wrong in the crash period?
Well, I don't want to leave out what started in 1980 when Jimmy Carter appointed Paul Volcker.
Who's viewed as a hero now.
Who's now regarded as given sainthood. What Paul Volcker did was smash labor, smash the economy, drove the country into a deep recession with enormous dislocation and really destruction of American industries in order to break inflation. It is true he succeeded in breaking inflation, but when he let the economy grow again and pop out of recession, and there was a big boom that reelected Ronald Reagan, etc., he continued to hold down the economy, which wasn't visible to people, but except labor people knew it, because they couldn't get a contract that's worth anything. And they kept losing jobs to Asia and so forth. All those – anyways – Then it moves to Alan Greenspan, who is a true crackpot in the libertarian sense, and he says, well, the markets can do these things better than government, so I'm just going to let the markets run. And he did, along with deregulation, and we now know the results of that. After the crash, the Fed did what the public was shocked by. It pumped trillions of dollars into the ether of markets and banks and even non-banks like General Electric and General Motors, all of this stuff. And normal Americans quite reasonably asked, hey, where did it get this money? And I would write, and others would kind of sort of clear their throats and say, well, it created it. Created it? Yes, out of thin air. And I was tickled by this, since that's what I explained 20 years old earlier about how the Fed really worked. But the establishment richly deserved the anger that was directed at it, and the Federal Reserve especially deserved it, because they have operated for 100 years on a mystique that the public couldn't understand any of this stuff. It's too dense. It's too sophisticated for them. So they throw out a bunch of bromides. And now the reality has hit the public right in the face. And that's a political event which I think the Fed is not going to recover from. I mean, it's going to be changed. I can't tell you precisely. Yeah, one more point. And here I will be sympathetic. In the last 3 years, the Fed is in disfavor. People like me are banging on its mistakes. And for God's sakes, don't reward them for their mistakes and so forth. And the Congress, run by Democrats, Barney Frank and Chris Dodd, etc., and Obama, says, well, people are upset by this too-big-to-fail thing. They're upset by all of the crazy fraud and everything else. Let's turn it over to the Federal Reserve to reform the system. And that's the bill, that's the law they passed. The Fed, and I'm going to try to write about this if I can get some good reporting, the Fed is now in a dilemma. It's been told, find a solution to all this. We've told the public we've banned too big to fail. Now tell us how we're going to do that. And there isn't a solution. And it's conceivable. Their regulations have been a year and a half after that bill was passed. They're still not done. Mm-hmm. I think they're stuck. Meanwhile, the banks are getting wobbly again, especially Bank of America. So we may have a situation, if we're unlucky and the economies all over the world begin to crater again, we may have a situation where the government, meaning the Fed, is going to have to bail out these banks again. Mm. And dare they do that, given what's happened so far? I think the Fed has now been put in the crosshairs by the politicians. And good luck.
And the slogan from the Occupy Wall Street, banks got bailed out, we got sold out, really resonates with people, because they saw the banks get, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars and trillions of dollars in guarantees, and the people didn't get anything.
And it's true. And I have an argument I've made again and again, and I will make it again in the future. If the Federal Reserve can offer that kind of gorgeous support for wobbly financial institutions, then it can provide at least modest financing for the people and the institutions of the real economy. And we have now before us a really dramatic example, which is the housing crisis is stuck. The housing I've got a piece coming on this, where one of the housing people, not from industry, not from politics, said the death spiral in housing is going to be recreated if they don't do something. And what they have to do is reduce the mortgage debt dramatically. That is, give forgiveness to all of those families that are underwater and give them a new mortgage that they have at least a shot of being able to pay. That is, a reduced interest rate. And they will begin to get a little equity again in their home. Now, if they do that, that's going to be a huge help to the economy. The Federal Reserve ought to, through Fannie Mae and other institutions, ought to provide financing for that change like it's done for the banking system.
And it can do it with Fannie Mae, but what always surprised me was when they were ladling out the money and when first Bush and Obama had the banks dead to rights, that they didn't make the banks agree as a stipulation for getting the money that they'd reduce everybody's principal or not foreclose on people.
Absolutely. It's that straightforward. And I think, actually, a big chunk of the public understands it in just those terms. And, you know, some of us, you included, I'm sure, were writing that at the time. You don't have to nationalize the banks, but you do have to put them under a kind of a conservatorship and say, if you want to get some rescued by us, here are our terms. The banks could not have said no to that. They couldn't have turned that deal down. Now, I think they're in a different situation where the banks are still fragile. Some of them are probably still insolvent, despite what they claim. And if they give up, write down their capital, they will be in deep trouble. They can't deny that. But our side should argue, hey, these mortgages they're holding are never going to be paid. All they're doing now is grinding these people down, getting the last pound of flesh out of them before they foreclose. And that's not productive for anybody. But they're not ever going to collect on those assets anyway, so they've got to take their hit.
Yeah, the only thing they demanded was the ceiling on executive compensation, which was a kind of a cheap populist bone to throw people. Did nothing for the economy.
And it also turned out to be symbolically pretty important, you know. And it's hurting them every day because they're still pumping out these bonuses, and the public makes note of that.
Right. They repaid the loans as fast as they could so they could give themselves the big bonuses.
Yeah.
It's just crazy. What do you make of Occupy Wall Street?
Oh, I'm exhilarated by it. I think it's brilliant. I think the people who put it together have really put together a serious representative collection of people and feelings, ideas. You know, the media tries to say, well, what's their agenda? I said in a blog in the Nation that it's humanity stupid. Remember Carville's, it's the economy stupid? This is what these people are saying. And humanity has been pushed aside by this era of money first and so forth. People know that. You can answer that a million different ways, and I hope that this effort endures and spreads. I think it will. And it will crystallize soon enough into hard proposals and real legislation, whatever. But right now, it's resonating all over the world.
I'm speaking with William Greider. He's, of course, the National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation magazine. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive Magazine. It's great to have William Greider on the show, Progressive Radio. You know, it makes me almost laugh when the corporate mainstream media say, oh, I can't figure out what their demands are. When you say we are the 99%, it seems pretty clear that the demand is for some kind of economic democracy.
Well, and I love to watch. You get the same thrill I do, probably, picking up the Times, the New York Times and the Washington Post, or even the Wall Street Journal, and seeing these reporters wrestling with this subject and trying to be respectful. On the other hand, it scares them a little bit. On the other hand, they can't describe it very well. So they quickly settled on, this protest is about corporate greed. And I said, yeah, okay, I'll buy that. That's short and simple, and it pretty much sums it up. It's about corporate greed.
You know, I've been wondering until this erupted, until also the uprising in Wisconsin erupted in
February and March of
2011, which was great to behold. What was taking people so long? And still we don't have, even though there are 15, 16 million people unemployed and 5, 6, 7 million people foreclosed upon, you don't see the masses of the unemployed and foreclosed upon in the streets even yet. Maybe they're coming. Maybe they're participating now in this Occupy Wall Street. But what's taking it so long, do you think?
I've asked myself the same question, and I don't have good answers. I do think the folks who are getting pounded, not all of them, but a lot of them, were the same folks who supported Obama in 2008 and were thrilled historically by his election and want the best for him and all the rest. So they're naturally inclined not to beat him up for what's happening to them. And I agree with that, actually. And furthermore, if you're left of Newt Gingrich and the other crackpot right-wingers, you have sympathy for government, or at least you have more respect for it, and you criticize it and pound it for its mistakes, but you do expect government to step up and solve things. So that was inhibiting, I think, to people in how they think about this. That's over, I believe. I think these protests, you know, the one in Wisconsin really was the first occupation of you know, really bringing democracy back into an existing space and showing the world this fight is just beginning. I think we'll see more events like that. I hope so. And I'm very tolerant of people marching up the wrong road. I mean, we all do that in our lives. So these are citizens trying to discover again what it means to be a citizen. Mm. Isn't that exciting?
It's exciting. It's beautiful. You mentioned the crackpot Republicans. It's astonishing to me to believe after the crash on Wall Street, which came about because of a failure to regulate, that they're still calling for less and less regulation. I mean, the evidence, they don't really care about the evidence.
Well, they're getting a free ride because that's boilerplate from the Chamber of Commerce and the Business Roundtable and the National Association of Manufacturers. We all know where that's coming from. The Tea Party crowds are not meeting in church basements to say we've got to stop this air pollution amendment that's going to cure asthma for our children. If we get the debate down to that level, we win that debate. Social Security is another one. If the Republican Party wants to go down that road and attack Social Security, they were going to get their head handed to them just as they have before. I think they've gotten away partly because Obama was too nice to them and didn't frame the argument quickly. They've gotten away with their anti-government line because it didn't get concrete.
What do you make of Obama?
I'm conflicted like a lot of people. I think, and it's silly to go back over this and argue it. It is possible that a lot of us, and I don't mean policy junkies or political junkies, but just normal citizens, conferred a lot of hope on him, which was bigger than he intended. And it's also possible that he misled us a bit. It doesn't matter which of those is right, maybe both. But I would say a year and a half ago, I began to grasp that this guy is not who I thought he was. He's still very smart, and he's still earnest, and he's still sincere and progressive in his viewpoint. But he's governing in a way that's wrong. I mean, particularly on the big stuff like financial regulation, economic policy. And I still continue to hope that he would, you know, move away from that. He disappointed that hope. Now I think at last he realizes, or he's beginning to realize, that he's in a very deeply threatening political situation on re-election, and he's raising it up. What I have written in The Nation, and it irritates some readers, and others agree, that instead of running away from Obama, people of good and progressive intentions, old libs, labor, everybody else, need to run at him. And I mean that in a purposeful way. If you go back to the history of the 30s, those same groups ran at FDR all the time, and they got pretty rough. There were thousands of labor actions across the country before the labor rights law was had. There was a national campaign for Social Security before FDR had the nerve to endorse it. And that's the history we're in now. You can't let this guy sail through with weak promises and sort of boilerplate solutions that won't solve. This debt reduction issue is one of those issues where everybody, you don't have to be an expert to know that's got to happen. And everybody should pound on Obama, in a nice way, of course, but pound on him.
But on this debt issue, William Grider, he started to speak out of the Republican playbook by making the debt and the deficit into a much bigger issue than it was.
He hasn't crossed the bridge yet. I mean that literally. He's still. And this is my piece on the housing crisis says very bluntly, the bankers don't want to solve this problem because they're still collecting the last drips and drops of money out of these failing homeowners, and Obama is standing with them. Now, he makes noises now and then that he's going to change, and I hope he does. But he can't get away with another sort of phony voluntary program where you leave it to the bankers to do the right thing. The bankers are not going to do the right thing until government forces them to.
And you call in your book, great book, by the way, Come Home, America, this debt and deficit obsession root canal economics. I love that expression.
Well, that's where we're heading into that now. And I predict root canal politics will fail miserably, just as it always did in the past, whether it's done by Democrats or Republicans. I think Obama and his very weak team of advisors is beginning to awaken to that reality. But they haven't yet turned around. And I recognize how hard that is to do. But he's not got a lot of time. He's got basically 12, 13 months to change his profile and the substance of his policies.
How tough do you think Mitt Romney's going to be if he is the nominee?
I'm not one who disparages his prospects. I think he's, first of all, he's not nuts. He's a moderate conservative Republican. His record in Massachusetts recommends him as a not unreasonable person. I don't know how smart he is. I'm not taken by his personality, as many people aren't. What I'm told by some of my political friends, and I don't know if they're right or not, I tend to think they're not, but they say very ardently, Mitt Romney can't get the Republican nomination. The hard right and the Tea Party crowd and the Bible bangers will stop him. If that's so, then we're going to get one of those other characters, and then I think Obama's got a pretty good hand. So I, like a lot of other people, I'm hoping that's true.
I want to take us in our last 2 minutes more broadly. In your book, Come Home, America, you have a chapter called America the Possible. You say our country can emerge as a far better place, and you call yourself an optimist. Why are you optimistic, and how do we get to that better place?
First of all, I'm genetically optimistic. I can't help it. I'm from the Midwest, right? But more profoundly, I think this country is at a historic turning point, unlike any before it. And let's be honest with ourselves. We didn't do it, we the people, but we certainly participated in 50 years of glorious, somewhat arrogant conduct in the world and at home, and pretended, many still pretend, that this will go on forever. Now we're slammed into the wall by events, many of which we caused ourselves and might have avoided if we were focused on reality. And again, it's not we, it's the people, the governing elites in both parties that did this. And so the question now is, will we be mature enough to rearrange our priorities, get rid of the hubris, and adopt a really decent regard for mankind and a balanced view of our own future? That means, among other things, getting out of the war business. The people have wanted that for a long time, and we are not very close yet. Second element is trade. The elites sold so-called free trade to the politicians and not to the people, and the people were right. I can go on in other venues. I see all of those as if democracy can get a hand in this, we can straighten ourselves out.
Well, I sure hope it does get a hand in it. William Grider, thanks so much for being my guest today on Progressive Radio. It's been a real pleasure.
Likewise.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.